This is Laura Dierdo with the Becker Spine and Orthopedic Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Mick Perez-Cruitt, a neurosurgeon who is vice chair and professor in the Department of Neurosurgery at Oakland University William Beaumont School of Medicine and director of the Minimally Invasive and Spine Surgery Program and a clinician at Michigan Head and Spine Institute. Dr. Perez-Cruitt, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast today.
Pleasure to be here, Laura.
I'm really excited to speak with you. I know you're a leader and on the forefront of a lot of different things going on in minimally invasive spine. But before we dive into the questions, can you tell me a little bit more about yourself and your background?
You bet. So first of all, I'm a neurosurgeon. I did my medical school at Tufts University in Boston, and then went on to do my residency at Baylor in Houston. Under Dr. Bob Grossman. I did my Tufts Medical School under a health profession scholarship provided by the Air Force, and then went on to do 4 years of active duty as vice chairman of the Department of Neurosurgery at Wilford Hall in San Antonio, Texas. After that, I went on to do a fellowship with Dr. Richard G. Fessler in Chicago at Rush University. It was a minimally invasive and reconstructive spine fellowship. I stayed on at Rush and then subsequently moved to Michigan and started a practice at the Michigan Head and Spine Institute with Dr. Daniel Piper. We've since grown that to now have approximately 20 neurosurgeons and a variety of other specialties. I'm now at Beaumont, where we have a ACGME residency program, very active in a number of projects, and really focus my practice on minimally invasive spine surgery.
Well, it's really fascinating to hear, and I, you know, was wondering, first off, can you talk about the top three trends that you're following in healthcare today?
The top three, I guess, that I think are interesting is to see how the development of patient-generated outcomes are kind of steering spine surgery and what we do. We have a very unique collaborative in Michigan called the Michigan Spine Surgery Improvement Collaborative, or MISIC, where we've now entered over 50,000 patients into that program. The program is largely administered by Henry Ford Hospital, but is funded by Blue Cross and Blue Shield. And so we're able to collect data on spine surgery patients throughout the state of Michigan, both that have had surgery in academic programs and in private practices. And then we discuss their outcomes and their results to find better ways, more cost-effective ways of treating these patients. And I think we've really made a tremendous impact. We've published a lot of papers concerning the findings based on the outcomes. So we're kind of turning the tide, trying to reduce the cost of spine care and to improve care.
Got it. That's really interesting to hear about. And, you know, when you think about having all that data, how did you set it up to where you were able to, you know, make sense of all of it? Is it something that was pretty easy transition to make, or was there anything in the process that kind of surprised you in terms of getting the data and trying to understand it and then apply it to providing better care?
Well, I have to give real credit to both Blue Cross and Blue Shield, the insurance company. These are the payers, and Henry Ford. I mean, they've done an absolutely fabulous job. And working closely with physician leaders like myself, I'm the surgeon champion at Beaumont. My colleague and orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Jad Khalil, and we work collaboratively. I'm on the publications committee. We got a great publications committee. We review projects to go forward and do research on and publish on. But more importantly, we meet frequently via phone calls to discuss things with all the surgeon champions from all the different sites. I believe there are 40 plus sites enrolled in the program. And we meet almost quarterly together. You know, it's been a challenge with COVID, but we meet and then we go over the outcomes, the unique way of targeting, let's say, urinary retention. That can be very costly. When we first started this program, Beaumont had a urinary retention rate of 18%. And had we not really looked at the data and recorded it, we probably never would have known. We made changes and we're now down below 5%. What that means is that we're sending less patients home with Foleys. We're having less readmission for urinary retention and problems. And this results, when you look at 10, 20, hundreds of patients, in significant cost savings. We have found that early ambulation within 4 hours of surgery really reduces a lot of the problems that we see postoperatively with spine patients, such as infection rates, blood clots in the legs and so forth, and urinary retention. So when you start to look at the data and collect the data from many different sites, and then what we'll do is we'll blind each site from A to Z, and we'll look at which sites have the best results, let's say the highest urinary retention, and which sites have the worst result, the best results, the lowest urinary retention. And then we can look at those sites that have the lowest urinary retention and say, what are they doing that prevents this? And what we found in doing that was early ambulation was key. So we can help reduce the cost and improve patient outcomes.
Got it. That's really fantastic. Are there any other trends in healthcare right now that you're looking at and think really could make an impact on spine care in the future?
Well, you know, I'm biased, of course, but I really think, you know, minimally invasive spine surgery is providing tremendous benefits to our patients. You know, I've written a lot about this and developed devices and technology, which I've been fortunate enough to bring to the marketplace and help patients. And I really think that's exciting. I think the challenge is to take these new approaches and to effectively teach surgeons how to apply them to improve patient care. This takes a lot of work. Our national organizations, of course, are key to training. I run an organization called MINS, or Minimally Invasive Neurosurgical Society, and we try to give conferences and hold cadaver labs to teach surgeons how to perform these procedures more safely and effectively. So to me, that is a tremendously exciting area. I see the results in my patients, and it's nothing better than to get a patient that's been suffering from chronic debilitating pain, not just for months or years, but decades, and literally turn them around and have them do whatever they want to do in their lives. That's extremely rewarding as a physician and really the reason why I went into healthcare.
Got it. That is really exciting. And, you know, what are some of the most promising devices and technology developments in spine right now? And on the flip side, is there anything that, you know, is more hype than reality or just not quite ready for prime time?
Yeah, I do think that we are definitely getting better at cervical arthroplasty. Lumbar is still, you know, we've gone through the phase of, you know, excitement and maybe even hype, and then we've had to pull back a little bit. But I'm, you know, some of the newer technologies that are being released, that really mimic the natural motion and behavior of the spine, I think are really outstanding. You know, we've had this fight about you know, fusion versus arthroplasty, and is there any difference? But I think as we get closer to understanding better the true physiology of motion and developing devices that mimic that, I think it's a very exciting area, and I'm seeing improvements in my patients using those devices.
Got it. That's really fascinating to hear. Now, you know, what are you most excited about today, and what makes you nervous?
I'm most excited about the prospects of biological restoration of spine function. And what I mean by that is, you know, we've been involved in a lot of research, particularly stem cell research, dealing with disc regeneration. This is something that's on the horizon, but one day I would love to be able to treat patients to actually restore, not using a device, but using biologics to restore the natural function of the intervertebral disc. And the focus would be on the nucleus pulposus, how to restore that function. We actually are looking at developing a device that distracts the disc over time. We've not been able to bring it through, you know, of course, into the marketplace. It's still a long ways off. But if we could first restore the height of the disc, we call the device annulo, and then restore the integrity of the nucleus pulposus. Once the height of the disc is restored, then restoring the actual nucleus pulposus cells within the disc and the glucosaminoglycan matrix that holds the water and actually maintains the height of the disc. That could be fascinating. That's one area that's fascinating. I think the other area that really needs to be delved into that I don't think we've done a good enough job is really understanding the underlying pathophysiology of spinal disorders. Meaning, you know, why does spinal stenosis occur? It occurs, in my opinion, from an undue loading of the facets and the ligament and flavum to put a cascade called the mTOR cascade, and understanding at a cellular and even a genetic level what is occurring that leads to that condition. Because when you ask most physicians, well, why does spinal stenosis occur? And it is one of the most common things that we treat as surgeons. So why does it occur in the first place? And the answer is, well, it occurs from the facets getting large and the ligament and flavum getting large. Well, that's really the result. It's not the process. So understanding the cellular and genetic process that is occurring, you know, is very important to understanding really how to treat that condition, in my opinion, more effectively.
Absolutely. That's, you know, another interesting point, and really just a lot to be excited about and look forward to. Now, kind of for both things that you mentioned, but especially looking at some of the disc regeneration aspects of the research and development in the space, how far away do you think we are from being able to have a solution? I know it's obviously still in the very early stages, but, you know, when you think about the technological developments, what kind of timeline roughly do you think that type of innovation is on?
You know, it's a lot of getting through the regulatory hurdles. Anybody who's done an investigational device exemption knows that, you know, you have to, first of all, you know, the patents, then the prototypes, the protection of the IP, so that a company that does decide to take a product to market, you know, can actually get a return on their investment. And then the prototypes have to work, and then they have to be manufactured and tested and meet FDA requirements. And then the FDA submissions and subsequent approval to do an IDE study. And then conducting IDEs is multiple years. It takes many years, at least 2 years of collecting data from the patients, and new technology requires, 5 years of data collection and so forth. So it is a long process to get these. And then once they get out on the market, whether they'll be effective or not, that's the next step. We've seen many products that have gotten out on the market and got a lot of fanfare and hype and then are no longer used. So we certainly saw that with many artificial disc devices. So it is a process. I anticipate for true biologic restoration of the disc, probably looking at a decade.
Got it. That's really fascinating to hear. And I know, once that is developed and available, I'm sure it'll really make a big difference and have some huge monumental changes in the way surgeons look at the spine and treatment for patients. Well, Dr. Perez-Cruet, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. This has been a really fantastic discussion, and I look forward to connecting with you again soon.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you for having me.